I suspect that you will find this evening an unusually moving one. The lives and the actions of the individuals chosen to receive the Wallenberg Medal are so dramatic and so powerfully engaging that you will likely find yourselves caught up in them and renewed by the experience. I have seen this happen in previous years. I look forward to its happening again tonight. When a small, dedicated group of faculty and staff began to raise money for the Wallenberg Endowment several years ago, they decided that the funds would support a public event to honor someone whose life, like Wallenberg's, had made a difference. Once the endowment was complete, this group approached the graduate school, asking that we assume the responsibility for carrying out its terms. While we were delighted to do so, we determined to put our own particular stamp on these activities, which, not surprisingly, involved graduate students. Each spring, we now select one or two graduate students whose scholarly work is related to the humanitarian goals and values of Raoul Wallenberg, broadly defined to include the study of all groups subject to persecution and the historical and social conditions of such persecution. These students become Wallenberg Graduate Fellows, and we award them a full summer's worth of support for their work. The Wallenberg Graduate Fellows also have the opportunity to accompany the Wallenberg lecturer throughout the visit. Thus, we have added a dimension to this evening's event. We honor a public figure for his or her outstanding achievements, and we recognize, through a kind of continuing continuity, promising graduate students who will further the goals of Raoul Wallenberg through their own intellectual work and commitment in the years ahead. Let me introduce the Raoul Wallenberg Graduate Fellows to you, and will they stand as their names are called? Is Stephen Frank with us? Julia Burge? And I know this year's fellows are here, Maud Mandel and Colin Leach. Now it is my pleasure to introduce to you an individual who was most pivotal in the creation of the Wallenberg Endowment, Irene Butter, Professor of Public Health Policy and Administration. Professor Butter's gentle demeanor belies the intense energy and tenaciousness with which she has pursued the goal of creating this lectureship. I know you will find her personal story to be a very moving one as well. Professor Butter.
The Honorable Helen Sussman, President Duderstadt, Wallenberg donors, and friends. First of all, a special welcome to those of you who were present at previous Wallenberg events to hear the lectures presented by Elie Wiesel and Jan Karski. I hope you will become regulars in attending the annual Wallenberg lecture, which is a very important event in our university community. To those of you here for the first time, also a hearty welcome today and to future Wallenberg commemorations. 1992 is an election year, and it has been said many times that this is the year of the woman. It is therefore appropriate that today the Wallenberg Medal is awarded for the first time to a highly distinguished woman. I hasten to add that the Honorable Helen Sussman has received numerous awards over many years predating the Year of the Woman. It is a great honor, indeed, to have you with us today to present the Wallenberg Lecture. In the recent past, we have witnessed gigantic changes in the world, and particularly in those parts of the world in which Wallenberg disappeared at the end of World War II. Our hopes were raised by headlines such as KGB hands over Wallenberg documents to Sweden and new panel plans Moscow meeting in investing the Wallenberg fade, expecting that the truth might finally be uncovered. But what happened to Wallenberg remains shrouded in mystery even to this day. What brings us all together here today is to pay tribute, validate, and reaffirm Raoul Wallenberg for his courageous acts and heroic leadership during World War II. Because Vollenberg is one of the most extraordinary alumni of this university, and because of a lasting need for creative leadership and positive role models for our youth today, the University of Michigan established an enduring vehicle for celebrating and emulating Vollenberg's remarkable deeds. This vehicle includes three elements: a medal awarded to a humanitarian of international stature whose work reflects the spirit and the essence of the Vollenberg legacy, and that is the Honorable Helen Sussman today; a lecture delivered by the medalist; and thirdly, a remembrance of the Vollenberg story as a bridge to the medalist whose humanitarian contributions receive recognition today. And this last part is my task, the Vollenberg story. Raoul Vollenberg was born in 1912 into one of Sweden's most highly respected families, whose members included diplomats, bankers, bishops, artists, and professors. For valid reasons, Vollenberg's relatives chose the University of Michigan as the most suitable of American universities for his advanced education. And thus it is that from 1931 to 1935, he attended the University of Michigan, where he completed an undergraduate degree in architecture, which he earned with honors. After graduation, Vollenberg returned to Sweden and embarked on a career in banking and finance, which led him to work in different parts of the world, such as South Africa, Israel, and several European countries, and this happened during the late 1930s. His first exposure to Nazi atrocities committed against the Jews took place in Haifa, where while in employment with a bank, he witnessed the arrival of large groups of Jewish refugees forced to leave their native countries. A few years later, he became junior partner to a Hungarian company in Europe, and this new position required frequent travel within Europe. In this way, Vollenberg encountered many uprooted Jewish families all over European territory. These wartime experiences, combined with his citizenship of a neutral country, his family background, and other personal attributes, qualified Vollenberg to be appointed as a Swedish diplomat in 1944 with a very special assignment, namely to protect from execution the only substantial Jewish population still alive in Europe, the Jews in Budapest. During a brief 6 months, and I think it's important to remember that it was only 6 months from July 1944 to January 1945, that Vollenberg made his mark on history. Here he rescued tens of thousands of Jews from Nazi execution with boldness, defiance, persistence, and enormous courage. Clearly, he embraced his mission with utmost dedication and vigor. The tactics he used, including false protective passports called Schutzpässe and the safe houses, which were buildings declared to be Swedish territory, were innovative and daring. Moreover, Vollenberg is said to have performed his rescue operation almost single-handedly, thus providing a supreme example that no matter how formidable the odds, one person can make a difference. What Vollenberg demonstrated more than 45 years ago is every bit as applicable to the world of today. One person can make a difference in the struggle for a better world. And this is why the Vollenberg story is to be celebrated and perpetuated on this campus each year. It symbolizes defiance in exposing tyranny, fortitude in defense of justice and human dignity, courage in the midst of a world that was trembling in fear, and steadfastness when virtually everyone was apathetic and silent. It gives us gratification to think that during Wallenberg's formative undergraduate years, this university helped to shape the foundation for the monumental acts which followed. Thus, our celebration of Wallenberg's heroism on this campus is intended as a lasting inspiration to each of us, that we too can be that one person who makes a difference in building a better world. Thank you.
The Wallenberg Lecture is terribly important to the university because in many ways it sets the tone for the year ahead. And yet, there are many themes that we find today. I think it's a tragedy of our time that it's difficult to pick up a newspaper or turn on a television without being bombarded by stories of racism, ethnic cleansing, hate crimes, neo-Nazism, and as well being reminded of our own failure to act as a global community and to be little more than a traffic cop to the atrocity which occurs on our planet. It's all too easy to look the other way. Accountability would demand scrutiny, and the closer to the surface that bigotry and hatred rise, the more frightening they become to us. But it's also the case that a great flame can follow a small spark. The power of one individual can make all of the difference. Helen Sussman is such an individual. Her life's work is a repudiation of the status quo, a challenge to those of us who are capable of helping our sisters and brothers who are tormented in every corner of the world. Helen Sussman was a senior member of the all-white South African House of Assembly, representing Houghton, a suburb of Johannesburg, until her decision to retire in 1989. She'd served in Parliament since first being elected in 1953. Her parents were both Jews who immigrated from Lithuania at the turn of the century. After entering university at age 16, Ms. Sussman received a bachelor's degree in commerce in 1941 from the University of Witwatersrand. Before entering politics in 1953, she was a part-time lecturer in economics and economic history. Ms. Sussman has received 18 honorary degrees, including the degree of honorary doctor of civil law from Oxford in 1973. She's been nominated for the Nobel Prize for Peace 3 times. She's also received the United Nations Human Rights Award, the Berlin Senate's Moses Mendelssohn Award, and been named Honorary Dame Commander of the British Empire. During her first terms in Parliament, Ms. Sussman worked with other United Party representatives to control the growing power of Hendrik Verwoerd, the foremost proponent of apartheid laws. In 1961, like-minded politicians joined Mrs. Sussman in forming the more liberal Progressive Party. The election that followed left Mrs. Sussman as the lone voice of the party in Parliament until 1974, when 5 other Progressive Party members joined her. Mrs. Sussman was the only female representative in the body for the first 27 years of her service. Mrs. Sussman has repeatedly tangled with former Prime Minister P.W. Botha and other members of the Nationalist Party on the floor of Parliament, never failing to meet their constant attempts at intimidation head-on. In response to a thinly veiled threat from Botha, Mrs. Sussman replied, "I am not frightened of you. I never have and never will be. I think nothing of you." Since 1960, Mrs. Sussman has regularly visited detainees in South Africa in an attempt to monitor and prevent police abuse. When allowed, she visited now freed African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela during his nearly 3 decades of detention. When asked about her persistence in face of the seemingly intractable system of apartheid fostered by her political opponents, Mrs. Sussman has said, "The most soul-destroying thing one can do in South Africa today is to live here and do nothing about the situation and to do nothing about the injustice around us." It is this commitment, the commitment to do something, that sets apart women and men like Helen Sussman. She is an individual who's saving lives in the face of intimidation and extraordinary personal sacrifice. For Helen Sussman, passivity has never been an option. Her home is a place where unemployment, poverty, violence, and despair surround its children from the day that they are born. She has been immersed in a struggle, and she meets it head on. Tonight, we honor Helen Sussman, and we honor the memory and the humanitarian efforts of Raoul Wallenberg. But let us also use this occasion to recommit ourselves to an aggressive, relentless pursuit of human rights. Individuals like Helen Sussman don't pay attention to headlines. Atrocities and inhumanities continue long after the media moves to other stories. Let us allow her efforts to be a lesson to each of us so that we do not ever forget the fact that in some corner of the world, at this moment in time, someone is suffering at the hands of a bigot, their dignity lost. Mrs. Sussman, you inspire so many of us all over the world. On behalf of the Wallenberg Endowment and the University of Michigan community, it is my great privilege and honor to present to you the Raoul Wallenberg Medal.
I suppose I have to make a speech after that. Well, that's an absolutely wonderful medal, and I shall treasure it, take it home with me. It will join one or two other little tokens I have, such as a medal given to me by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, and a medal given to me by Mayor Ed Koch, which I must tell you, he dropped on my foot when he gave it to me. It was a very large brass medal, and I limped around New York for several days thereafter. I'm very glad, President, that you didn't drop this on me, because it's also fairly heavy. But I really do treasure this, and thank you very much indeed. I'm deeply honored at being the third speaker at the Wallenberg Memorial Lecture. I think it's a wonderful thing that the University of Michigan has done to have an annual lecture to commemorate the memory of this great man who saved so many lives during the final years of World War II. Now, I want to say at once that, honored as I am, I'm very well aware of the fact that I don't measure up to in any way the two previous recipients of this award. I'm not in the same league as Elie Wiesel or of Jan Karski, both of whom really suffered, I think, very considerably. Elie, as you know, Wiesel was a survivor of the Nazi death camps and has spent a great deal of his life thereafter in making sure that the world doesn't forget what happened and that what happened should not happen again. And Jan Karski was, I think, one of the persons rescued as a result of Wallenberg's efforts. And he actually had considerably tough time, more tough time than anything that I can assure you I have experienced. I have really not suffered personally in any way, and the courage that everybody talks about really wasn't even required. Stamina, yes, but not courage. That really wasn't difficult at all, even being the lone woman, not, by the way, for all the years that you said, President, but for 6 years I was the only woman in the South African Parliament, facing a lot of very chauvinistic males indeed. And it early dawned on me that in order to be considered equal, one had to be better. It also dawned on me that that wasn't too difficult. Now, the award which has been established in the name of Raoul Wallenberg is dedicated to the proposition, as Irene has said, and as you have said, President, one person can make a difference. It is true that I was, for 13 years, the only member of the South African Parliament who represented a party whose pronounced policy was the rejection of race discrimination. And since in South Africa, right up till now, the only people who vote for Parliament were white people, you can imagine this was not exactly a very popular party. But as such, as a member of a party which rejected race discrimination, my name was very often recorded in Hansard, which is our congressional record, as the only person voting against many of the racist laws which the government introduced during the period that I was the lone Progressive Party member, and that is between 1961 and 1974. It is also true that I was the only person to oppose the many acts introduced by the National Party government, which came to power in 1948, and which is still in power, which abrogated the rule of law and due process. And that is to say, they were laws that allowed detention without trial. To that extent, I suppose, I can claim to have made a difference, at least, to the statutes as recorded in Hansard and in keeping certain values alive in South Africa. But I myself was never imprisoned. I was never detained. I was never banned or banished. Nor did I personally suffer under any of the other repressive laws that have been implemented in South Africa for more than 40 years. It is true I was subjected to a good deal of abuse, both inside and outside Parliament. I was called a sickly humanist. I was called a perfect example of an unpatriotic South African. I was castigated as one who fought only for the rights of black people without concern for those of white people. And I was told in Parliament by the previous state president, Mr. P.W. Botha, that I was a vicious little cat. I rather like that. I was also told to go back to Ghana, to go back to Moscow, or to go back to Israel. That is, until Israel won the Six-Day War, and then Israel was too good for me, and I was sent back to Ghana. I must tell you that after Israel won the Six-Day War, I was stopped in the corridors of Parliament by many Nationalist Party members who usually averted their eyes when they saw me. But they stopped in their tracks, shook me by the hand, and said to me in Afrikaans, "Mooi skot, Helen." In other words, good shot, as if I had been responsible for the winning of the 67 war. Well, they obviously identified themselves with a small, beleaguered country surrounded by dark-skinned enemies, and of course they identified me, being Jewish, as an Israeli. But anyway, that didn't last long, because soon afterwards Israel voted the wrong way at United Nations, and after that, as I say, I was sent back to Ghana again. Now, despite enduring such hostile attacks and the strenuous efforts that I had to make as the only member of the Progressive Party, I can't say that my life bore any comparison to the treatment that Elie Wiesel, Karski, and of course Wallenberg endured. Indeed, I must tell you that I feel very privileged indeed to have had a ringside seat during 36 years when I was in Parliament, from which I could observe at close quarters nearly four decades of South African history. It was particularly rewarding to be able to challenge the government on its sins of omission and commission. And I was very glad to have had the opportunity to take advantage of my position as a member of Parliament to visit prisons, to see the conditions there, to raise the issue in Parliament, to make public the manner of treatment of prisoners. I finally got permission to go to Robben Island, where political prisoners were kept, and that is where I first made the acquaintance of Nelson Mandela in 1967, long before he was the world's most famous political prisoner. And of course, I can tell you we have an enduring friendship as a result of the fact that I took the trouble over and over again, whenever I was permitted to do so, to take the ferry boat from Cape Town to go to Robben Island to see Nelson Mandela and his fellow prisoners. As a result, I have friends, ex-Robben Islanders, whom I run into at all times in South Africa. Now that things have changed, they are out of prison, they are back from exile, and indeed I feel I can almost have a Robben Island old boys club. We have such a very close relationship. All of this was because of my status as a member of Parliament. I could visit the dreary resettlement areas where thousands, hundreds of thousands of black people had been forcibly removed to from their ancestral lands because they were designated as black spots in white areas.
I was able to put up ongoing strong opposition to the past laws which inhibited black South Africans from moving around their own country in search of good jobs, and which prevented them from living normal family lives since they came into the industrial areas as migrant workers, leaving their wives and children behind them in the so-called black homelands. I was able, because of Parliament, to expose the cruelties of the Group Areas Act, under which many thousands of Indians and coloured people, that is, people of mixed blood, were moved from their homes and businesses across the railway tracks, next to the cemetery, out of town, away from the main streets where their livelihood was being earned. I was able to fight the indignities of the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act and the prohibition of sex outside of marriage across the colour line. I was able to fight the inferior system of education for black people, whereby unqualified teachers were teaching students and condemning millions of young blacks to lives of functional illiteracy, which permanently handicapped them and enabled them to be employed only in unskilled and semi-skilled jobs at low wage rates. And of course, I fought four things. I fought for the extension of trade union rights to blacks, and I fought for the extension of the franchise to people of color, and opposed the laws which reduced the few voting privileges which colored people and some black people enjoyed in South Africa. I made a point of attending funerals of black people killed by the police in an effort to reduce the violence which might once again set in motion the dreadful spiral of police shootings, deaths, and funerals. But none of these activities really entailed real physical danger for me. There was always a possibility one might get shot, of course, attending these things, but in fact, I never felt threatened. There were a lot of abusive letters, most of them anti-Semitic, by the way, and there were lots of threatening phone calls in the dark watches of the night. Again, many of them anti-Semitic, and most of them threatening to come and get me. None of them really bothered me, and I have had a very good way of dealing with these phone calls in the dark watches of the night. I kept a very shrill whistle at my telephone, and when one of these voices would threaten me, I used to blow the whistle very hard down the phone, and one would hear, and you knew you'd knocked out the eardrums. And I recommended to those of you who are victims of heavy breathers in the dark watches of the night. So I used Parliament, really. I used it to expose many things which might otherwise have gone by default, and I put hundreds of questions to ministers in Parliament. We have a very useful device, which I don't think you have in Congress, of putting questions to ministers on the order paper of Parliament, and they have to reply to these. Sometimes they say it's not in the public interest to give the information, but very often one does get the information, and this information has been used throughout the world as a result of the inquisitive inquiries which I made year after year. On one occasion, one nationalist minister was so irritated with me, he said, "You only put these questions to embarrass South Africa overseas." And I said, "It's not my questions that embarrass South Africa, it's your answers that embarrass South Africa." Well, I had lots of satisfaction in confronting the government eyeball to eyeball, because it was an interesting fact to me that the government of South Africa, which was reactionary, autocratic, and totalitarian in many respects, had great respect for the institution of Parliament. And therefore, as an elected member of Parliament, I was able to have my say. And I had a very lucky indeed to have as the Speaker of Parliament during my years alone, a man who was right-wing, member of the National Party, and indeed when he left Parliament, he actually joined the far-right Conservative Party. So his views and mine were poles apart. But he used to send for me at the beginning of every session and say, "Helen, I do not agree with a word that you say, ever. But it is my duty as Speaker of this House to see that minorities have their rights. And you will have speaking time whenever you want it." And that really was the key to my success, if I may call it success, during the years that I was alone, was that I had a speaker who understood the rights of minorities And I got more speaking time, I think, than any other single member of Parliament, because I tried to speak more often, and I put more questions than anybody else. I got more private members' motions debated as a result of all this. And whether or not any of these speeches had any impact, I really don't know. But certainly, as far as I was concerned, they kept my party alive, and they kept values alive in South Africa. And for that, I must thank not only the Speaker of the day, but also the English medium press in South Africa, which gave me wonderful coverage, largely, of course, because I was saying the things they felt ought to be said, and because, as the only member of my party, I was voicing opinions and objections which they felt ought to be voiced. So I have a great debt of gratitude to the English language press in South Africa. Now, I concentrated on the rule of law, that is, on human rights, fighting detention without trial, and, of course, race discrimination. But I also did devote myself to economic affairs, to education, particularly black education, to health matters, and particularly to gender affairs, received my attention, though they were not priorities. The priorities, really, as I say, were rule of law and race discrimination. I suppose to sum up my years in Parliament, I could paraphrase the words of Theodore Roosevelt: I did what I could, where I was, with what I had. I think that sums it up. That's exactly what I happened. Now, a demographic picture of South Africa will give you some idea of what it's all about. There are roughly 5 million white people in South Africa. There are 3 million people of mixed blood, so-called colored people. 1 million people of Asian descent, people who came to South Africa, largely to work in the sugar plantations as indentured labor in the 1860s, and many of whom remained after their period of service was over. And there are something like 30 million black people, Africans, so that 39 million people, 39 estimated population of 39 million, 30 million are black. And there's no doubt that the demographic picture is much loaded against the white minority, the colored and Asian minorities, and it is this fear of domination by a black majority which has largely been the basis of political policy in South Africa over many years. And I might add, many years before the present government came to power in 1948. It might well be said, since the time of the Union of South Africa, which was formed in 1910, of the two Boer republics and the two English-speaking colonies, the Cape Colony in Natal, the Orange Free State, and the Transvaal, which came together after the end of the Anglo-Boer War, which was fought at the turn of the century and ended in 1902. No provision was made at that time for the extension of the franchise to the black majority population, and I believe this to be a serious dereliction of duty by the British government, which had great say over the constitution of the Union of South Africa, which was not an independent country, it was part of a colony of Britain, and only became independent very much later. Britain at that time, of course, was imbued with colonial attitudes to the indigenous populations, such as India and other parts of Africa, which they dominated. And when South Africa became an independent republic in 1961, under the National Party government, and of course there was no idea of that government, which had come to power under the slogan of apartheid, segregation of the races, there was no intention, of course, of rectifying the basic omission in the 1909 Act of Union. Instead, from 1948 onwards, the jigsaw puzzle of apartheid was assembled in an attempt to achieve separation of the races in every facet of life. Educational, children had always gone to separate racial schools, but the universities now were also segregated. But to their everlasting credit, my own alma mater, the University of the Witwatersrand, and the University of Cape Town ignored the law and continued to admit black students, albeit not very many, but they did continue to admit black, Indian, and so-called colored students. Politically, of course, the the franchise was not extended. The vote was, in fact, exclusively white, except for the Cape Colony, which retained the vote that the colored male population had enjoyed. The black male population had also enjoyed the vote, but that was removed way back in 1936, in General Smuts's time, to his discredit, unfortunately. He agreed to the removal of the black people from the common voters' roll, and they were given instead three white representatives on a separate roll in the lower house and four senators in the upper house. Socially, acts were passed which prohibited marriage across the color line and sex across the color line. And those, in fact, persisted on the statute book until the mid-80s. Economically, there was job reservation. Skilled jobs were reserved by law for white people only. And that persisted until 1979, when job reservation in industry was removed, but it remained on the mines until just 4 or 5 years ago as a result of the very strong white mine workers' union. So we've had all these difficulties over all these years. Other economic strictures were that black people could not belong to legally registered trade unions, and it was not until the late 70s that they were permitted to have black and mixed trade unions. So that we had all these acts on the statute book which ensured separate and inferior education for people of color, laws that reserved the skilled and well-paid jobs for white people only, laws that set aside occupation and ownership of land and property on a racial basis, with the whites obtaining the best land and the most land, although they were only 13% of the, a small percentage of the population. They had 70% of the land, and the blacks, who were in the majority, had the remaining amount of land, black, colored, and Indian. Separate but unequal public amenities, such as beaches, were set aside to ensure further racial separation. And so, as I have said, the National Party completed the whole process of segregation of the races in South Africa. And this persisted until the late 70s, when several changes took place, such as the recognition of black trade unions and the abolition of job reservation. In the 80s, the pass laws were abolished, to my great relief, because I always felt those were the most oppressive laws of all, preventing blacks from living normal lives with their families, turning them into migrant workers only, and, of course, making it impossible for them to enter the urban areas unless they got permits. So that literally millions of black people were arrested over the period that I'm talking about for being in the urban areas, for they came in despite the fact that they weren't permitted to be there, simply because the so-called black homelands had no jobs to provide them with a livelihood. Well, by 1986, those laws were abolished. And to my amazement, black leaders, from Archbishop Tutu down, brushed this aside as being of no importance, although those abolition of those laws had always been at the very top of their lists of oppressive laws that they wanted repealed. Well, the reason, of course, that there was no real reaction to the repeal, as there should have been, was because at that very same time, the government introduced a state of emergency in South Africa, detained hundreds of people without trial, and in the ensuing consequences of all these things, the repeal of the pass laws passed by without proper recognition. Now, over the last 2 or 3 years, as Irene has said, the whole world has experienced a sea change. We've seen the end of the Cold War, the breakup of the USSR, the Gulf War, the disappearance of socialism and communism throughout Eastern Europe, and more recently, and indeed tragically still happening, the ghastly civil war in Yugoslavia. Now, South Africa has also experienced vast changes over the last few years. At the end of 1988, my bête noire, who called me a vicious little cat, State President P.W. Botha had a stroke. He resigned as head of the National Party, and his place was later taken as state president by Mr. F.W. de Klerk, and a whole new era began for South Africa. It was heralded by the state president's speech at the beginning of February 1990, when he announced in Parliament that it was his intention to convert South Africa into a new South Africa free of oppression and discrimination. And certainly since then, he has removed the legislative foundation stones of apartheid, those that remained. The Separate Amenities Act has gone. The Group Areas Act has gone. The Land Acts that restricted the purchase of land and property by blacks has gone. Indeed, Nelson Mandela now lives in a house in Houghton, my old constituency, where I went to visit him not too long ago. And I said, what a pity it was that I'd left Parliament in 1989. I would love to have been his parliamentary representative. And he said, yes, he agreed it was a great pity. And many blacks have moved into the white suburbs, but of course they are few in number because houses in the white suburbs are, of course, expensive, and not very many black people can afford them. But nevertheless, the legislative restriction has gone. The Race Classification Act has gone. And one might say that was the basis, really, of the whole apartheid system, whereby every South African at birth was classified, or, if not at birth, then retrospectively, as black, colored, or white, with several subdivisions in the colored group. That's gone. There's no race classification anymore. The Internal Security Act, which allowed detention without trial, has been materially altered so that the period of detention without trial, which was unlimited, is now limited first to 10 days, then they extended it over all the violence to 21 days, and thereafter the courts have the right to intervene. Well, you can imagine how gratifying it's been to me to see the disappearance of racist and oppressive laws from the statute book, laws which I opposed vigorously when they were introduced, and it is also extremely satisfactory to me that many of the sentiments that I expressed during my 36 years as an MP, which were received with ill-conceived disgust by my colleagues in Parliament, have now become government policy. Indeed, I must tell you that the government has accepted a portrait of me, no less, which now hangs in the corridors of Parliament, to solitary one, really, because the others are all of ex-speakers, ex-ministers, ex-state presidents, and they are in another corridor. I hang in solitary splendor in a corridor, and one of the ministers, cabinet ministers, told a member of the press gallery that every time he walked past my portrait in the corridor, I seemed to be saying, I told you so. Well, now, discriminatory acts can be abolished with the stroke of a pen, and that indeed is what State President de Klerk has done. But of course, the legacy of apartheid remains to be dealt with. Racism per se does not disappear just because discriminatory laws are repealed, or even, in fact, if civil rights laws are introduced. It certainly, I think, diminishes attitudes and behavioral patterns of racism because people are affected by the law. The law does educate the way in which people think. But all of you, I believe, will admit that although the United States has had civil rights legislation since 1964, you cannot claim that America is free of race discrimination today. Indeed, it seems to me that the very fact that there exists, after so many years, apparently, the need for a black caucus in your Congress suggests that racism still prevails today, even if you leave aside the ugly incidents such as the Rodney King incident earlier in Los Angeles earlier this year. Now, as I say, many of the laws were repealed even before State President de Klerk took office. But nevertheless, the legacy of apartheid still persists. And I fully understand the moral outrage about the apartheid system. After all, that's what I've been involved in fighting all these years. but I was not prepared to support a policy which I knew would impoverish South Africa and which in fact would weigh most heavily on the people it was intended to help. In other words, the people who lost their jobs as a result of sanctions were largely black people, because the sanctions were imposed against our exports, like mineral resources, and by the way, the moral outrage didn't extend sufficiently for you not to exclude the minerals that you wanted yourselves, so that vanadium and platinum and chrome were not on the list of the forbidden exports, because South Africa was the main producer of those minerals. But when we lost our coal markets, when we lost our sugar markets and our wool markets, many thousands of black people lost their jobs, and South Africa, unfortunately, has got a very inadequate social welfare support system. There is no dole, and there are no food stamps, and unless you belong to an occupation where you contribute to an unemployment insurance fund, you get little support from the government. And I was very often the receiving end of black people imploring me to find them jobs, which had disappeared with the sanctions policy. And therefore, I was very much against sanctions, which I likened to curing the disease but killing the patient, rather like an overdose of radiotherapy to a cancer patient. So I was, as I say, very upset that to see the results of the economic sanctions, and I was delighted when the 3A Act, the Anti-Apartheid Act of America, was repealed. But I must tell you that sanctions still remain against South Africa from this country. The Graham Act, for instance, stays on your statute book, and it affects South Africa's ability to obtain loans from the International Monetary Fund. And many states, cities, and county governments in the United States still retain their strictures against firms that do business in or with South Africa regarding contracts. And a number of universities, and this may well be one of them, refuse to invest pension and trust funds in such companies. Are you one? You are. See? I knew it. Well, thank you for not picketing me. Well, I do not, of course, dispute that sanctions have expedited the disappearance of apartheid. But as I say, in so doing, they have been extremely destructive. It is now of fundamental importance that South Africa receives a huge injection of investment capital in order to jumpstart what is a stalled economy and to provide jobs for the thousands of unemployed people, mainly black, who are marginalized by the lack of growth in the economy. I've been watching your elections with great interest, and every candidate for nomination, every candidate for the Senate or for the House of Representatives talks about the need for jobs, talks about the need to get this recession over, talks about the need to get the economy going. I can assure you the situation is exactly the same in South Africa. We have to get the economy going. Indeed, I might say that as a result of the unemployment, crime, ordinary crime, has increased to such an extent in South Africa that I think it is no exaggeration to say that security services are the only growth industry in the country at present. That is, the services providing guards for houses, providing razor wire for walls, for people who build walls, and even Rottweilers. They're also a growth industry in South Africa. Township violence has resulted in something like 13,000 deaths since 1984, and since 1990, 7,000 deaths. Murders not connected with political factors reached the alarming figure of more than 11,000 between July 1990 and June 1999. And I might tell you that this violence does not convince the white minority that it should hand power over to the black majority, and has made the road to reform and de Klerk's task ever so much more difficult. We have got to provide jobs for something like 400,000 young black people who come onto the labor market in South Africa every year. And if we don't, whatever future government takes power in South Africa will inherit a wasteland inhabited by an embittered and totally undisciplined generation of young people. Now, what was the cause of this sea change in South Africa? What changed State President de Klerk? He was not a frustrated liberal. We never considered him that. He was always considered to be on the conservative side of the National Party caucus. So it did come as a great surprise to many people, including myself, that this man, as courteous individual as he was, intelligent as he is, as opposed to his predecessor, who was an irascible bully, is the only way to describe him, it was came as a surprise when he made his announcement of the new South Africa. Well, there were many things behind the change. First of all, it was becoming so expensive to maintain apartheid in an economically integrated society. We were ending up with 14 departments of education, very expensive civil service. The whole thing was becoming top-heavy and extremely expensive. Secondly, there's no doubt that apartheid was failing in the face of the irresistible tide of black urbanization. Despite the pass laws, despite everything, blacks were streaming into the urban areas from the impoverished black reserves. And one simply couldn't just go on putting people in jail. Indeed, in the 2 years before I left Parliament, I asked in Parliament how many people had been arrested under the pass laws, and the answer was 500,000. Well, you can't just go on shoving people in jail for the crime of looking for work. Then there was South Africa's growing isolation, not only as far as the loss of export markets was concerned, but the loss of international respectability, which upset very many people. This began preying on the nerves of South Africans who didn't like to be considered a pariah nation and excluded from international sport, which we very dearly enjoy, and such as the Olympics and other types of international competition. But the third reason, and it is one which is very often overlooked and underplayed by black people themselves, and that is the enormous effect of the escalation of black resistance to the laws, the apartheid laws, by means of boycotts, stayaways, and strikes, taking to the streets in protest marches and other forms of opposition to the government. The United Democratic Front had been formed, a conglomerate of some, 400 organizations, including the trade unions, which was protesting constantly against the government. And all these escalating forms of resistance, together with the other factors, were beginning, as I say, to have a very marked effect on those in government. All these were the factors that caused the change in policy and the effect of the breakup of the USSR. Because one thing that the National Party government constantly used to explain its policy was that it was the bulwark against the total onslaught of communism in Africa. Well, with the breakup of the USSR, the total onslaught no longer had any meaning, though I have to tell you that the South African Communist Party continues to exist in the teeth of everything. It's probably the only communist party. Perhaps you've got one here, but I don't think it's very important. But the one in South Africa is important because it has a number of its members on the Executive Council of the African National Congress, which is very important. And of course, it's got considerable influence in the black trade union movement. So that continues to exist. Well, all these were the reasons for the changes. And the government, having failed to coerce, now had to look for forms to conciliate. And of course, the first attempt was with the release at the beginning of 1990 of Nelson Mandela and his fellow prisoners in February 1990, the return of the exiles under amnesty, and the unbanning of organizations such as the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress. There was the practical implementation in the setting up of what was known as CODESA, the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, of which I was a member from the Democratic Party, which is what the Progressive Party eventually became, having merged with two other parties. And I was a delegate to CODESA. And I might tell you, I kicked up a great fuss about the few women who were in that organization. There were 228 delegates, and looking around, you could count the women delegates on the fingers of one hand. And I raised a big fuss about this, and eventually the CODESA set up what was known as a gender advisory committee, keep the girls quiet. It really was disgraceful. I mean, I don't want women there just because they're women, but there are thousands of competent, well-trained, intelligent women who clearly had a right to be at CODESA. Anyway, these 19 political organizations met in December last year, and they went very far in accepting a number of very important principles. What has been accepted is universal adult franchise. In other words, everybody is going to be on the voter's roll who is an adult South African citizen, irrespective of race, color, creed, or gender. Proportional representation in the electoral system, which I believe to be a very good idea because it does enable parties which are minority parties to get some form of representation. A bicameral system of parliament, such as you have here with your Senate and your House of Representatives. A Bill of Rights, a justiciable Bill of Rights, which means one that can be implemented by the court, such as you have here. An independent judiciary, not necessarily such as you have here. And very important, all very important principles. And there was a declaration of intent to bring about the new South Africa with a constitution based on these principles, and it was signed by all but two of the participants. The one was Inkatha, and the other was Bophuthatswana, both of which wanted to have a more federal content in the constitution, which would give them greater regional rights and authority. Now, CODESA was supposed to meet again in March, but it was twice postponed because two things happened in the interim. I'm talking now about this year. The National Party lost two important by-elections, and the official opposition, which is far right in South Africa, the Conservative Party, demanded a general election of the white electorate, but the government instead held a referendum among the white electorate. And that took place on the 17th of March this year, and the government put this question to the electorate. Do you support the continuation of the reform process which the state president began on the 2nd of February 1990 and which is aimed at a new constitution through negotiation? And the government received a handsome 68.7% yes vote on that referendum. And that confounded, I may say, the pollsters, many of whom predicted a no victory. What they didn't take into consideration was the fact that South Africa was at that time, had been allowed back for the first time in 22 years into international cricket. We're very fond of cricket. And we were playing in the World Cup in Australia at the very time that the referendum was being held. And we had reached the semi-finals. And the rumor went round that if a no vote succeeded at the referendum, South Africa would not be allowed to proceed. It so happened that rain spoiled play, and because of some curious Australian rule, the opposing team, which was Great Britain, was allowed to go on and South Africa didn't continue. But the threat of a no vote was enough to bring thousands of people out of the woodwork who otherwise wouldn't bother to vote. And this very handsome percentage was achieved by the government. You know, it's always extraordinary to me, who's fought all my life for people to have the franchise, to find that when they're given the franchise, they don't bother to use it. And I had a very good example of this in America this year. I was in Indiana, where I gave a few lectures at the University of Indiana, another great state university, if I may grace say so, on these hallowed premises. And a friend of mine said she had to go and vote in the primaries, and would I go with her? And I said, I'd love to. I was very interested to see how the little machine worked that you use. And we drove for miles into the country to her polling station. And I must say, there wasn't a soul to be seen. I said, this is voting day. She said, yes, we're voting for the primary. She said, but of course it's a foregone conclusion that Clinton's going to be the Democratic candidate and that Bush is going to be the Republican candidate. I said, yes, but I understand you vote for a lot of other things in the primary, don't you? Postmaster and the school board chairman and things like, oh, yes, she said, we do. I said, well, where's everybody? She said, well, I don't know. Anyway, we walked into this little hall, and there were two ladies there who were examining the ballot numbers, and she gave her name and address, and she was told to go into the booth. And I said, do you mind if I go in with her? I want to see how this machine works. And they conferred, and I said, yes, okay, you can go in. Of course, it was wholly illegal, I learned later. But anyway, I went into the booth with her, and I watched her tapping out all the names and so on, and there was this little part which said, write in, and I said, go on, write my name in, I'm just as good as Perot. Well, she didn't write my name in, of course, but I thought I was just as good as Mr. Perot. Anyway. Anyway, we came out of the booth and we stopped to say thank you to the ladies. And the one lady looked at me, she said, excuse me, where do you come from? I said, I come from South Africa. Oh, she said, you're a missionary. Well, I've been called a lot of things. I've been called a lot of things in my day, but I'd never been called a missionary before. And of course, I suppose this was the Bible Belt or something, and what would a white woman be doing in Africa except converting? So, you know, we had a good laugh about that. But, I mean, people don't vote, and I bet you're going to have a low percentage this time, too. Whether it's because you don't like either candidate, I wouldn't know, but it's amazing how you've got to persuade people to use their democratic right to vote. And it always, as I say, infuriates me who's worked so hard to get people to vote. Anyway, the referendum went the way the government wanted it to do, and CADESA finally met again in order to consider proposals of five working groups which had been set up, but it broke down. And no agreement could be reached, although the major principles had been agreed upon. But the main reason was that the ANC was against a federal system, and the government was for it, and most of the participants were for it. My own party's for a federal system. I think it's much better to devolve power down to regional areas rather than leave all the power centered at the top. And this was the major disagreement, and also the percentage approval to be required by the body which was going to actually write the constitution for the various proposals. The ANC wanted 66 and two-thirds, which I thought was reasonable, and the government wanted 75%, which was unreasonable. In the end, they settled for 70%. But they could not get to agreement on the rights of regions and whether the powers would be delegated or whether they would be entrenched in the constitution, the way you have states' rights, which are entrenched in your constitution. So although it was not too difficult to reach agreement on the important basic principles that I've mentioned, like the Bill of Rights and the independent judiciary and the universal franchise, when it came to actually reshaping the political power structure in South Africa, that proved to be very much more difficult. And there was a stalemate, and CODESA 2 adjourned and stands adjourned now. On the 17th of June this year, we had the terrible massacre at Boipatong, which was a black township just south of Johannesburg. 42 people were killed, many others were injured. And the ANC used this as a legitimate excuse to cancel all previous agreements it had made at CODESA and withdrew from all negotiations. I think the ANC was glad to have this opportunity because many members of its executive council and grassroots members of COSATU and the Communist Party and of the ANC, in fact, did not want any concessions to be made at CODESA to the National Party government. There, I, by the way, went to the funerals, as I say, I often went in order to try, just the very presence of people there stops further sort of shooting. And there's no doubt there were very militant speeches made at Boipatong, where de Klerk was accused of having fomented the violence, which was nonsense, although there has been more and more evidence accumulating that there are hit squads operating which are keeping violence at great, great tension, great heights, and that there are people who might belong to the far-right parties in South Africa or who may belong to the lower ranks of the security forces who have not accepted the idea of reform that are fomenting violence on the trains, at processions, at protest meetings, and at so on. And so the ANC withdrew its agreement and said it would not negotiate again until it presented 14 demands to the government, one or two of which are fairly easily, I think, conceded, and others which have already, in fact, been agreed upon. But there is this suspicion that there is this hit squad operating and keeping violence at high pitch. And although a judge, Judge Goldstone, has been appointed to see what can be done about the violence, although Mr. Cyrus Vance was sent out by United Nations to come and see what he could do to suggest manner in which violence could be reduced, township violence, and also to see how the negotiations could be put on stream again. The violence, I'm afraid, still continues in South Africa, though the incident that you may have read of in the Siskei, which is one of the four independent homelands, was in fact violence which I think was foolishly provoked by the ANC, which thought it could just march into the homeland and displace the head of government who is anti-ANC, a black man called General Khoza. And of course he wasn't going to have it. I mean, it's not likely that if 20,000 people appear in Washington and start marching on the White House to demand that the president resign, got an idea, that it's likely to happen. You know, it won't happen that way, obviously. So it was a very foolish, risky, and provocative thing to do, and it resulted in the death of a further 29 people. I mean, it really has become a very violent place, and until that ceases, you will not get investment coming back to South Africa because you need a stable country if you are to attract investment from abroad. Now, the next thing was that the ANC demanded a day in which it was going to have stayaways. And it was fairly successful, a national stayaway, successful in that many people turned up, although one doesn't know how many of those people who pitched up stayed away from work or didn't have work to stay away from because of the unemployment. And I might say that industry was very understanding that this was a stayaway as a memorial to the people who'd been killed at Boipatong. So they agreed for this particular thing that there would be no work, no pay, but also no disciplinary action taken against people who stayed away from work. Now, whether that will be their attitude in future is another matter, and also it is another matter whether the trade unions can afford this, because you have to keep people eating if they're not working and they're not earning any pay. So it's very interesting to see how the future, shall I say, confrontation between government and the trade unions and the ANC are going to work out. Now, the United Nations has sent some monitors out to see what they can do about the violence. But I have no doubt whatsoever, and it may even have happened now while I'm away because I haven't seen the paper today, that negotiations are going to be on track again. There's no alternative. The ANC cannot unseat the government by violence. It has no army. Whatever it has could never cope with the South African Defence Force, which is well-trained and well-equipped. And these stayaways, as I say, are very potent weapons, but they have got to be sustained for a long period of time before they really have the effect on bringing down the government in power. So they have no alternative, actually, but to go back to the negotiating table. And the government has no alternative. It is on an irreversible course. It is unthinkable that the government can start reimposing apartheid legislation again. So both parties are going to have to go back to the negotiating table. And I am not optimistic that tomorrow or even in the foreseeable future we are going to have a peaceful and prosperous South Africa. But I am certainly hopeful that that is going to happen. And I'm hopeful because there are many plus factors in South Africa. We have got a very good communication system. It is not a developing country without good communications, we've got excellent communications, we have got very sophisticated telephone system, we've got an excellent transport system, we have got sophisticated financial institutions, we've got good agriculture when we're not beset by droughts, which we are at the present time, and we have got mineral resources, not as rich as people think we are. You can't pluck diamonds off the streets, but nevertheless, we do have good mineral resources. And best of all, we have got an excellent human. We have excellent human resources. We've got an innovative population, excellent people, and our people, despite all the racial hostility, etc., are used to working together. So I do not think there's any real reason why we shouldn't, in fact, eventually end up as a peaceful and prosperous country. But we have many hurdles to overcome. The legacy of apartheid, the rotten education black people have been given, the fact that there's a terrible shortage of housing because the government refused to build houses in the urban areas for the blacks who were coming into the urban areas. We've got squatter camps surrounding every major metropolitan city in the country. And I might tell you, when the government is now trying to move them and set up schemes whereby they clear the land, they put in reticulated water and waterborne sewerage and so on, wherever they're moved to, the NIMBY syndrome asserts itself. Do you have that here? Not in my backyard. In other words, wherever they're white suburbs, they object to having black squatter camps move near them. You can understand, because they're worried that their property values will decrease and that there will be an increase in crime. But these are hurdles which I think, with sufficient time, attention, and money devoted to them, can be overcome. And I believe that South Africa, with its great resources, mineral and material, human resources, is going to make it. And I believe this because I know that the vast majority of people in South Africa, irrespective of race, want the same thing. They want security, they want stability, they want better education for their children, and better housing for their families, and better jobs, exactly the same as the American population wants today. And so, as you feel hopeful for your future, I must tell you, I too feel hopeful for South Africa. Thank you. Thank you.
Mrs. Sussman has agreed to take one or two questions, if there are any in the audience. Yes. The question has to do with the possibility of some form of partitions if the current discussions do not work out.
Yeah. Well, you know, apartheid was a form of partition, and it failed. Indeed, there was an editor of the largest, you will know it. Did you say it came from Rondebosch? Yeah, very nice suburb in Cape Town. And Cape Town's a very beautiful city. You'll remember the man, Pietzer Lee, who was the editor of Die Burger in Cape Town. And he was a government-supporting editor. And he said in an interview a couple of years ago, we had to try apartheid to show that it would not work. One of the most cynical utterances I've ever heard, because of the devastation of the lives of millions of people of that failed experiment. Well, apartheid was an experiment in partition. That's what the black homelands were all about. Verwoerd conceived the idea that if you gave the blacks certain homelands, with the tribal lands, but very small and hopelessly overcrowded, unable to support the existing population, let alone any increase, that you could have an ethical solution to South Africa, because they would enjoy full political rights in their own areas and couldn't demand rights in the white areas. It tried, it's failed. Apartheid's failed. I believe we've got to try democracy to show that it will work. It's the only hope for South Africa. I think I'll stay up here.
Yes. Yes, back here. Yes, please. Yes, you.
Where are we?
Right here.
Oh, yes.